In the book of Galatians, the 6th chapter and the 9th verse, it says, "And let us not grow weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap, if we do not lose heart." We're talking about reaping. We will win. We will finish the course successfully if we do not lose heart. And when you talk about someone that's a Christian that's tired, you're not talking about something that has to do with your physical makeup, where you're weary, as you might well be now. Food's settling in, we've got the fans running, everything is kind of quiet here. But tired Christians are a different sort. You know, the Bible talks about the Christian in a number of ways, trying to explain our nature. It calls us sheep. He calls us farmers. He says we're soldiers. We're plants. Well, what I'd like to do is look at the book of Hebrews, the 12th chapter, where we're described as runners. In Hebrews 12, it says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Now I want you to notice what he says here first about being able to run this race. He says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us." Well, what is a weight? Can you imagine somebody that is trying to run a race, and as they run along, they see something interesting on the path, and they stop and pick it up and carry it with them? And perhaps the path is littered with these kinds of things, and after a while, their pockets are full. Does this help? That's why he's saying, lay aside every weight. Well, weights aren't things that are sinful in and of themselves. But instead, a weight is something that's a hindrance, something that slows you, something that prevents you from doing what you need to get done. You know, a lot of kids are involved with sports these days. It's an amazing thing. I just heard yesterday someone was talking, and they said that from Indiana, they said that there at Martinsville, there's a number of people that take their four-year-old to Fort Wayne, Indiana, so they can participate in a soccer camp. And I find that there are a lot of parents interested in seeing their children succeed. And so they will involve them with a lot of things in sports. And yet, nothing wrong with that. But how often do those kinds of things interfere with your ability to assemble with the saints? How often do you spend time thinking more about schedules and getting people here or there than you do about the Lord? How important does this loom in your life? It's not just sports. There are things we do that are hobbies. There are people that get involved where they're showing animals, and maybe showing a horse, showing a cow, and they have to travel a distance to do that. You can get wrapped up in all kinds of things. Nothing wrong with it, but it takes your time. And the question is, should I lay that down or not? I still remember Jim Basinger saying one time, I didn't know this about him, but apparently he was a very excellent fisherman. And apparently Jim was someone that people would pay to take them fishing. And he said that for a long time, when he would drive around to meetings, his trunk was full of fishing gear. But he realized it was taking too much of his time. He was spending too much time on it. And he sold everything. He never fished again. Lay these things aside if they keep you from serving the Lord. They're interesting. They take time. They take effort. They are a weariness. But they're also fun. They're a danger. And so the scriptures say, lay aside every weight. Now, it gets to sin. And if weights are hindrances, things in this world that pull us away, you could think of sin as a disease. Sin is something that cripples, something that atrophies the muscles. I ask you to think a moment about Judas. Remember the story of Judas? Who doesn't? As a matter of fact, I think the world is quite aware of Judas, because I looked and find anybody named Judas. In the United States, I don't know anybody that's named Judas. Was Judas called to be a disciple because he was a thief? Jesus picked Judas along with the rest as the disciple. He gave him the same opportunities that the rest of his disciples did. He spoke. He performed miracles. Judas was there through all of that. In fact, Judas was also given the ability to heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead. And no doubt Judas did some of that, because no one knew until the last that Judas was not what he's supposed to have been. And everything people thought, well, nobody said Judas is a question. Are you sure he's a good man? Are you sure who you want following us around? But Judas had control of the treasury. And you know, he may never have been a thief, but that it provided an opportunity, we don't know this. All we know is that he was called, and he was called as a good man. And in the end, as Peter said in Acts, he became a guide to those that crucified the Lord. How did that happen? The only thing we know about Judas is that it says he was a thief. And so if you can imagine for a moment the effect that sin had on Judas. What's wrong if you've got the treasury and you take a little bit out? Isn't the treasury for all of us? It's for him too. I don't know how he justified it or what he said. The thing is that he allowed this little sin, if you will, this dipping into the treasury, to persist. And over time, his heart became hardened. You can imagine how it must have been. Here you are at the tomb of Lazarus, and Jesus says, "Lazarus, come forth." And you're standing there with the rest. And that night, you go to the treasury box and you take a little money out and put it in your pocket. What has he been doing all along? He's been seeing the Lord, but it had no effect on him from preventing him from stealing. And there may be things in your life, you think, I'm going to be a Christian, I'm serving the Lord, I care about God. There's just this one little thing that I'm not dealing with. I'm not working at it. It's just in me. It's there. I do it. It's a persistent thing. The thing is, over time, you won't care anymore. It won't matter. Judas got to the point where he went to the chief priest. You know, there was no bounty on Christ. Nobody said, if you'll deliver Jesus to us, we'll give you so much. It wasn't anything like that. But Judas went to them and said, what will you give me if I deliver him to you? And the reason to do that was Judas knew Christ was beloved. And there were so many people around him all the time. And they were afraid that if they tried to take Jesus and there was a crowd around them, there would be some violence. There would be some pushback. People wouldn't stand for it. And so Judas, when he betrayed Christ, he came to them and he said, now, I will come and I will show you where he is, and you can lead him safely away. Judas betrayed Jesus. And all we have to go on, all we know is that he was a thief. But over time, the sin destroyed his soul. He lost his soul because he wouldn't keep himself on the right path. You know, beyond the pull of distractions like weights and sin itself that we're trying to fend off, it tells us here in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, it says that you have forgotten, in verse 5, you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now, what's he talking about when he's talking about chastening? He's talking about the things that weary us and discourage us. It mentions that in verse 3, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation. What he's saying is that in life, all the struggles and trials and problems and anxieties and worries that you have that weigh on you, and many times bad things happen to people that love the Lord dearly. And the question is, why? Well, the scripture says you've forgotten that this is chastening from the Lord. Well, how does that work? Let me just ask you this. Maybe this has happened to some of you, but how often, you don't need to raise your hands, but how often have you ever had your father spank you for no reason? Might just say, well, I might have missed it. You probably deserve it. They don't do that. Fathers correct their children because they've seen something wrong, and the intent is to train the child, to instruct, to correct. And they're watching to make sure it doesn't happen again. That's the point of it. It's not the idea that dad just loves to give you a blistering. They don't. And it really is true, those of you that are young, when you grow up, you'll understand that it really and truly does hurt them more. It will hurt you more than it will them. And I know you've heard that before. The reason for it, fathers make abundantly clear. You shouldn't have done that. You should have done this. I told you to do that and you didn't do it. Do it. What happens though with us in life? Something bad happens to us. How is that training us? How do I learn anything from that? I think the best example that we can go to is Job. If you think about Job, such a stellar example of what God wanted in a person. That God was pointing him out to Satan. Have you seen my servant Job? Kind of showing, look, here's someone that loves me. And then look what happened to Job. All to prove that he was a good man. But does Job understand? Is Job told why? Does Job know? In the 40th chapter of the book of Job, in verse 8, Job had said, why? Why? Why is this happening? And God has asked him, can you do this? Do you understand that? But Job 40 in verse 8, God says, would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? That's all he tells Job. Job says, I don't know why. And God says, yes, you don't know why. You don't know. And in the end, after listening to more of God's questions, showing God's omnipotence, God's power, God's wisdom, God's knowledge, God's strength, Job says in the 42nd chapter in verse 5, he says, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. He finally understood. God is in charge. God rules. God has judgment. He cares about you. He cares about us, and when bad things happen, and they are very painful, the scriptures say that. They say, no chastening seems to be joyful to the present. How can God let that happen? How is that right? We don't know. God does. And God just says, trust me. Well, still, I think we can see some value in the things that we go through in life. Some value in the things that we suffer. You know, yesterday Al Bowne was talking about buying a ring to get married. And he said that that ring cost $150. He had $75 in his pocket. This really disappointed him because he thought that would be sufficient. And he had to go back and work for the rest. What do you suppose, though, if a young man comes to a girl today and he wants to surprise her, here's a ring, but then for whatever reason he decides to tell her, I got that for $3. You think she'll appreciate it? Same person. It's just the money, isn't it? Not really. The point of it is, it didn't cost him anything. There's a man I work with who, well, I think if you looked the word tied up in the dictionary, his picture would be there. He is close with his money. But he came in one day and he said, you know, I gave my wife, it was our anniversary, and I gave her a box of candy. He said, I left the price tag on it, $3.99. And he said, I just wanted her to know how much I spent on it. And one of the other fellows in the room said, you know, I think it made a different impression on her than he thinks it did. You know? It just isn't money or cost how we value things? You know? You look at some poetry or you look at a story or something and it's childish. Or you look at some artwork and it's just kind of scrawled. Why is that not as valuable as something that if you look at it, it almost exactly depicts the real thing? And it's very detailed. Why do you think that's more valuable? Well, what kind of work went into it? Isn't that how we really do judge things? If something costs, that's what we value. So are you going to value the Christian life if, as you say, I become a Christian? Now, that's wonderful. Nothing ever happens to me anymore. I'm serving the Lord. God loves me. And I never am at a point where I feel like crying. I never have any disappointments. Everything's wonderful. You're going to appreciate what you have? What your service means to the Lord? How are you serving Him? How are you paying any price? How would you say, this is important to me? But what we do, when we go through life and we suffer, and we put up with things, and we are enduring hardship after hardship, it tells us, I love the Lord in a way that you do not understand any other. And there would be no other way to really understand it unless it cost you. I love the Lord. Well, what are you doing for Him? You're suffering. You know, Luke, the 14th chapter, verse 28 and then 33, it in fact specifically spells this out as a cost. Luke 14 says, for which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has, he cannot be my disciple. And it's called a cost. If you're going to start, count the cost. Think about it. It's going to take something from you that you would value. Another thing. And the scriptures tell us this already. It says in verse 11 of Hebrews 12, he says that it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Going through problems, going through trials, makes a change in you. It's not fun, but you're changed. You know, the first time you ever go to a funeral, the first time you've ever seen someone laying out in a casket, that has a huge impact on you. But over time, after you've attended 100 funerals, while it's still significant, it doesn't have the same impact because you have learned that it's something you can deal with. And if there's a death in your family, painful as it is, you get through it and you realize that you're not absolutely devastated and destroyed the next time someone you love dies. Going through trials and problems make us grow up. You're able to put up with things, disappointments. You know, little kids, going through the store, who hasn't seen a little one in the store start throwing a fit? I want this candy. And they can't have it. And they could throw quite a tantrum. I know it just seems to me like you go through Walmart and you can hear echoing through the store at least one parent somewhere, and I feel sorry for them because I've been there. You know, but they're going through what... In fact, one lady in a grocery store, she had three, and they were just carrying on, and I don't know what possessed me, but I did say, you know, one of these days you're going to look back on this and really treasure it. She didn't appreciate it. But you know, isn't it true? Don't you really? Do you remember that? You think, oh, I remember now when you lose one of your little kids in the grocery store, and they're running around, and they're trying to hide from you. It wasn't fun, because you're worried about them. But over time, with these kind of suffering, these kind of issues, we grow up. What adult? I mean, do we think of a person as an adult if when they're disappointed in something, they start throwing a tantrum? You start getting upset? What do you mean the plane is full and I can't get a ticket today? Sit on the floor, kick their feet? I don't think so. They just put up with it. It's happened before. You grow up because, and you are trained to say, all right, I'm mature. I'm not going to be devastated by this. I can deal with it. Ecclesiastes 7 verses 2 through 5 say, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Wisdom is in sorrow, it's saying. That doesn't mean that we have to go around trying to cry all the time and we're going to be better for that. But he says, don't look at the times that you're in sadness and hurting and think, this is not the way things ought to be. The way things ought to be is when I'm happy, when I'm overjoyed. If I'm bored, that can't be a good thing. I've got to be entertained. I've got to have my life please me. You know, we don't want to be spoiled, and God doesn't let that happen to us. Thirdly, you know, we had said that trials help us understand that we love God, but they're also a way to prove to God that we love Him. If we go through life and we never have to suffer for the Lord, is God going to think that that is proof? Remember Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter and verse 2, the story about the children of Israel wandering around in the wilderness. He says, and you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness. Why? To humble you and test you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. They didn't understand that. But by following the Lord, they were able to go on into the promised land. And God wanted to know. He was testing them. You know, you've got free will. You've got your own choice. You can do things. What am I going to do? Well, God says, since you've got free will, you can make a judgment. What are you going to do? What are you going to do whenever this obstacle comes in your way? That problem comes here. How are you going to deal with that? And if you keep the faith and serve the Lord, He sees it. I know we've already talked about Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Won't go into that. Do you know in John the 14th chapter, verse 15, the Lord says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And then in the 15th chapter, he says, if you keep my commandments, you shall abide in my love, even as I've kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. And then we go over to Hebrews, the 5th chapter, verses 8 and 9, where it says, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience through the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Jesus, by serving his Father, proved that he loved God. God had said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And yet because Jesus learned obedience himself, he then could say, I abide in his love. I love the Father because I'm going to do what he wants me to do. And God wants us to go through this life with all this troubles and trials and suffering. Now, I think it's interesting what he says in the first part of the book of Hebrews. You remember what he said, the very first part of that verse, first verse? Wherefore, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Why did he say that? Because chapter 11, big list of people that love God, that had faith, and that went through a tremendous amount of suffering. And he says, remember those people, how they suffered? He says in 1 Peter, the 5th chapter and verse 9, it says, resist him, that is Satan, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are experienced by your brethren in the world. We're not alone. You're going through trouble. You're not by yourself. And that helps. Remember Elijah? He'd had such a huge success just putting to shame all the priests of Baal. Just absolutely successful. And then within a few days, he finds himself running for his life. And he sits down and he said, Lord, take my life. I am no better than my forefathers. And God says, why are you sitting down? He said, they want my life. And what does God say to him? Remember? He said, I have reserved for myself 7,000 men that have not bowed the knee. God intended for Elijah to take heart, and we can take heart too, and should take heart, because there are faithful brethren right here going through all kinds of trouble serving the Lord. They talked about yesterday, I think it was David said, one of the secrets in the church was that the church is full of hurting families. I think, though, that it helps us if we understand, if we can help one another, can see the problems, confess your faults one to another. I think we can assist each other getting through things, because I'm not just facing this by myself. I know of others. You know, someone has in their family, maybe they've had 3, 4, 5 deaths. Wouldn't it be helpful if you go through something like that, or you've lost someone you care about, go to them and talk to them about this. And share your experience, share how you're thinking, what your feelings are. In fact, in Hebrews, the 10th chapter, just before all of the 11th gets here, verse 24 and 25, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. So what he's saying is stay together, stay in contact, be around one another, and you can help. You can help by just being there, by listening, and by being the kind of example that you need to be. Think about what the consequences of quitting is. You know, we talk about tired Christians, and what they're really saying again is, it doesn't mean that somebody's exhausted physically, but that means that you are on the cusp of quitting if you do not lose heart, so that you don't lose your faith. That's what a tired Christian is. He's nearly stopped. He's been running the race and decides the cost is too much. Philippians, the 3rd chapter and verse 18, the Apostle Paul says, for many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. If you aren't serving the Lord, then the Scriptures say you are an enemy. You know, when Judas betrayed Christ, really all he did was betray. He just pointed him out. Here's the Lord. But how effective then was Judas after that? Could he go back to the disciples and say, "My bad, I'm here. I'd like to join. I'd like to be part of this group." No, he couldn't. He had left. He was gone, and he was an enemy of the cross. If we leave, if we quit, if we decide to walk away, we are no longer God's servants. We are no longer submitting to Him. We do not love the Lord, and He knows it, and He will repay. You know, we're living a life that the Scriptures call a race, and it says, endure to the end. The race has been set before us, it tells us in the first verse. God set that up. He just says, stay the course. And it's something that we work our own salvation out with fear and trembling. If you find yourself dealing with sin, dealing with things that just pull you away, and you realize, I'm not what I want to be. I'm not what I should be. Just remind yourself that you can do it. Christ did it. Any kind of suffering or pain or sorrow you're feeling, Christ went through the same. Worse. Take heart, 1 Thessalonians, the 5th chapter. Verses 9 and 10, it says, "For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with Him." That's why He died for us, so that we could be with Him. He did not appoint us to wrath. We were not created to go to hell. All of us were created to be together in heaven. All of us. And if you're outside of the Lord this afternoon, want to make yourself right with the Lord, become part of God's body, become part of God's church, become part of His people, and serve Him. Become part of a team that will be with you all your life. Now's the opportunity. Let's extend the invitation then as we stand and sing. Won't you come forward?